This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello and welcome along to your weekly podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. For new episodes every Thursday, make sure to subscribe. This week, as we approach Mother's Day in the UK, we'll examine how mothers raised their families in the past. From the challenges to pleasures of motherhood, we'll draw on various stories linked to a number of English heritage properties as we look at life for mothers and for those who helped them from the 15 to 1800s. Joining us are senior properties historian Dr. Megan Leyland and senior lecturer in history at the University of Derby, Dr. Ruth Larson. Hello.
Hi.
Hello there.
And just a quick note before we do get started, our discussion will contain references to child mortality and pregnancy loss. Now, Ruth, many new mums today might consult a parenting manual, the internet or social media, or talk to their own parents or grandparents about raising children. So could mothers-to-be from the last few hundred years rely on any texts to help them?
Well, there was lots of advice out there, but how helpful it was is something that is subject to a great deal of debate. Amongst the texts that they could read were medical treatises, there were lots of sermons, didactic guides telling them how to do pretty much everything, as well as a lot of the domestic general advice books that had things about parenthood and more widely. Some of the advice was about how they fell pregnant, and there was one book called Aristotle's Masterpiece, which was first published in 1684, which was giving advice to the mother about whether she was expecting a son or a daughter, depending on what side of her belly the child was lying. Through the 16th and 17th centuries, as with other areas of life, of course, the Bible was the main guide. And it was often used to celebrate motherhood, but as long as it was within marriage. During this time period, scriptural references were used to argue that women were saved from sin through childbirth, but of course they had to be in a Christian marriage conforming to other ideals. In the 18th century, there was a lot more practical guides coming about, really shaped by the Enlightenment. And John Locke's book on education, which is still used by educational practitioners today, encouraged lots more. This included work by somebody called William Cadogan, who wrote a book called The Essay Upon Nursing. This encouraged mothers to make sure that they were looking after children in terms of how they fed them, how warm they should be, and how they should be cared for. But with lots of other texts, it was quite critical. It described a child, for example, who was, quote, languishing under a load of finery that overpowers his limbs, abhorring and rejecting the dainties he is crammed with, till he dies a victim to the mistaken care and tenderness of his fond mother. It's really interesting to note that so many of these texts were written by men, and so many of them were critical about the ways in which mothers reared their children.
It sounds as though the fathers were wanting the mothers to be a bit tougher.
Absolutely, yes. Or rather less the fathers wanting the mothers to be tougher, but rather more generally this idea that there should be a great deal of tough love, either through religious education or physical education. John Locke, for example, said that sons should be toughened up by being bathed in ice-cold water. They were wanting to make sure that they got children who were ready to be men in the world, sons in particular, who could fight in the forces. So they were really encouraging a form of tough education.
And life was already quite tough, I think, in those centuries, wasn't it?
Yes, most certainly. Although for the aristocratic families, they had lots of people to help them with parenthood and managing the children. And the children were often quite well fed. So for those who were living in the fine and country houses, yes, there were a great deal more medical risks, but they could actually have quite a happy and comfortable childhood.
Mm. Were there any other texts that you can point to?
Well, what was quite interesting was that during the 18th century, we see more and more texts written by women. We have those in earlier time periods, but they really grow during the 18th century, where we get women writing conduct literature. And one of the most popular ones was something written by Sarah Pennington called The Unfortunate Mother's Advice to Her Absent Daughters. And this was an account written by a woman who'd become estranged from her daughters. and this passed on general advice on how to navigate the social expectations of idealised womanhood, which was not only useful for rearing daughters, but also for the mothers and themselves.
So that's obviously something that you would have to cope with if you were in a noble family, I suppose. Just fallouts, family fallouts.
Oh gosh, yes, absolutely. And making sure that you were raising the children and properly in a way that suited them, suited the needs of the families, especially the in-laws. Young women, when they married into these families, sometimes they were in their very late teens or early 20s and suddenly were put into a situation. There was a great deal of expectations about running a household and being an effective mother. It could be really tricky for them.
How important a job was it then to be a mother in a noble family? For example, ensuring heirs and playing a role in family matters, being a matriarch in control.
Absolutely. It was really crucially important for elite families, but actually for a great many families, not just aristocratic ones. They wanted heirs. They wanted these to make sure that the family name could survive and thrive. And it wasn't just the eldest son who was important, although one woman described an heir as the one thing needful following the birth of her third daughter. But all children could help the family to grow and prosper through political work or other work, or through who they married. And because of the importance of offspring to an elite family, women who could bear children were in a powerful position. They provide the biological means to forward the dynasty. But they weren't just disinterested incubators of future aristocrats. These women were also empowered by their roles as educators of the children. And many mothers gained considerable authority over both their female and their male offspring. Women got status through being mothers if they were amongst an aristocratic family in this time period.
And what experiences would mothers to be, what could they expect once they've fallen pregnant?
Well, a great deal of scrutiny. It's fascinating to read about how much scrutiny mothers got, including Queen Victoria in her first pregnancy, which was covered a great deal in the newspapers. But once they fell pregnant, for many women, it was quite a worrying time for them. They were often quite concerned about whether they were going to survive childbirth, because while the risks of them dying was about 1 in 100 births, which is, you know, very high, if we remember that many women gave birth to 10 or even 12 children, that did mean that they were increasing their risk of dying in childbirth. They were also often scrutinised about how fertile they were. For example, we know that Georgiana, the 5th Duchess of Devonshire, who has connections to Chiswick House in London, that she was encouraged to go to Bath to take the waters to improve her fertility. And later, her in-laws complained when she breastfed her daughter because of the perceived contraceptive effects of breastfeeding. Because she'd not yet produced a son and heir, until she did, she was seen as not having completed her duties as an aristocratic mother. When you were pregnant, these aristocratic women often spent a great deal of time preparing for their birth. In the 16th and 17th centuries, this period of giving birth and the period of lying in, which is the name given to the month following the birth, was often spent indoor in the company of only women, including female relatives. Some of these travelled great distances to be there. One of them who did this, for example, was Lady Anne Clifford, who owned Brough Castle in Cumbria. She was a doting mother and ensured that she was with her own daughters during the birth of her grandchildren. Although the female-only atmosphere was in decline after the early 18th century because of the rise of the accouchère, the name given to the male midwife, the importance of childbirth as a time when the family came together really continued. So therefore, pregnant women often travelled to London to give birth. It was easier for relatives to go there and to visit, as well as them being able to access the best possible medical care. Being in London also allowed the public rituals of the aristocratic function of childbirth to be fulfilled. The expectation of a birth was often marked by straw being placed on the street outside of the townhouse, and messages were quickly sent across the city in order to ensure that relatives and acquaintances were informed that a new member of the family was coming. And this shed gossip all around the city. And gossip, of course, was the real currency of London society. Giving birth was a really important stage of life of an aristocratic woman, and it was something that was celebrated in the family.
Yes, I can imagine. It sounds a little bit like, you know, the press waiting outside of the Lindo Wing at the hospital that the royal family use in London. It's that sort of thing, isn't it? That sort of atmosphere, I expect, but just...
Yes, most certainly. They're desperate for news and really keen to find out what was happening. In part, this was to find out the gender of the child. Do they have a son and heir, particularly in one of the early pregnancies? But it was also out of a great deal of concern for the woman giving birth and making sure that everybody was fit and well.
And just what you were describing earlier, you know, when we started, you know, we've got these manuals, these various texts, mostly written by men, I think you said it initially. Later, there were women authors. And then, of course, you've got these other sort of bits of pseudoscience as well, haven't you, about breastfeeding. And they're really just working on the material that they had at the time and beliefs that they had at the time. It's hard for us to sort of understand some of these. We almost have to laugh at these beliefs, don't we, now?
Well, yes, and you know, there were some really quite odd beliefs, which, you know, continue a long time out of this time period, which was that if you were pregnant and you were shocked by something, it could affect the baby inside of you. There's a very famous example of Mary Toft, who falsely reported that she gave birth to rabbits because she was surprised by a hare when she was picking vegetables. But also this idea that if you ate certain vegetables or fruits, it could lead to a birthmark on the child. And this all shows the way in which there was a great deal of anxiety about childbirth. And a lot of Catholic rituals continued even post the Protestant Reformation because of the superstition of praying to particular saints, because it helped mothers stay safe. Praying to the Virgin Mary, for example, was something that expectant mothers often did, even when and the Virgin Mary was less central to the faith as it had been in previous Catholic time periods.
Was Mary Toft's claim of having rabbits, was that an April the 1st joke or something?
Oh gosh, it's a really interesting case. And it's quite difficult to unpick really what was happening. But she came to London, she was examined by various surgeons, including some royal surgeons, until eventually the case was shown to be false. But it is one of those examples of showing the ways in which understandings of the female body were quite complex, and even people who, the royal surgeons, their understandings of how pregnancy proceeded was often quite limited. Because of course they would have rarely have been able to see inside a pregnant woman's stomach. Most of the anatomical investigations in this time period were done on people who were criminals. And there was this idea that you could plead the belly if you were a pregnant woman. So actually, the anatomical investigation of a pregnant woman was really, really very rare.
So I'm just curious about this Mary Toft. She sounds like a complete wind-up merchant, but who was she?
Yes, this is almost another podcast, Mary Toft. Karen Harvey at the University of Birmingham has done lots of really great work on her. And what Karen Harvey sort of pointed out was Mary Toft knew that it was a false case, but it seems as though she got talked into it by other people, whether it's her husband, whether it's her mother-in-law, and whether it's actually something psychological taking place here, whether she was deeply upset by losing a child. It's actually really difficult to unpick the truth behind the situation. But it's the fact that it was taken up and believed by so many people is what's really interesting.
Megan, do we have any specific records relating to motherhood during this period at English Heritage Properties? So just to remind listeners, the 1500s to the 1800s?
Well, we absolutely do. And as Ruth's already mentioned, Lady Anne Clifford, the Duchess of Devonshire have connections to our sites. And really, it's not surprising or controversial to say that probably all of our sites have a history of mothering, motherhood in some way or another. You know, giving birth is essential, continuing humanity. And as Ruth also so really beautifully demonstrated, that mothering and motherhood was so profoundly shaped by culture and society. And we can see this coming through in some of the documentary sources that we have. relating to sites in the care of English Heritage. And so I've, in prep for this podcast, I had a little look back through some diaries, correspondence, account books and journals, some of which I went through quite a long time ago and which stuck in my mind because of some of the joys that they expressed, but also some of the grief and difficulties that came with motherhood. And talking specifically about quite a specific elite mothering and motherhood here, looking primarily at sort of country houses and castles. And I think one of the challenging things actually sometimes is finding the voices of those mothers themselves. And Ruth's already so beautifully talked about the voices of everyone else telling mothers what they should be and what they should do. I thought I'd just talk a little bit about the Hattons at Kirby Hall in Northamptonshire and a series of correspondence from the 17th century of the first two wives. He had three wives of Sir Christopher Hatton, the first Viscount Hatton, who inherited Kirby in 1670. He was the fourth Christopher Hatton to inherit Kirby, just to make life confusing. And it's really interesting because Ruth touched upon so much that we can find directly in this correspondence relating to their personal experience of mothering and motherhood, and particularly sort of to start off with joining up some of that stuff about pregnancy. So Cecilia, or Cicely Hatton, her maiden name was Tufton, writes about expecting her first child, Anne, who was born in 1668, and sort of comments on pains at night, that she's concerned about the pregnancy and she's concerned about being surely delivered of my dear baby, the fears of what's going on. And she's reassured by her mother that everything's going okay. And, you know, we have the internet now to look up, is this right? Should I be feeling this or not? But back then, those networks of motherly care were really important in doing that. And Ruth also talked about the concern of sort of getting a shock affecting pregnancy, having rabbits and things like that. And we see that in the correspondence of the Hatton family, where Cecilia, or Cecily's mother-in-law, says, you know, don't work now. It's not good for you. Don't even sew. It's dangerous. You should be taking care of yourself. You shouldn't be doing this while you're pregnant. And I think we see more of that, almost more of that anxiety, more of that concern coming through in the correspondence relating to Christopher Hatton's second wife, Frances Hatton. And it comes from those commenting on her pregnancy and also herself. And I just remembered, I should add, the amount of great bellies that are referenced is incredible. The great belly of Kirby. I think that visible outward expression of pregnancy was so important in the time when we can't see what's going on inside. That's an aside, though. And, you know, Frances Hatton writes during one of her pregnancies in 1677, I thank God I am very well and never was as fat in my life, and it makes me fear that my child does not thrive. So not only did you have these fears from hearing what happened with other people in pregnancy, Frances was quite concerned about how her pregnancy was going herself. And we think that sounds quite weird to us. I'm very well, but that makes me concerned that my child is not thriving. And, you know, a historian has pointed out that feeling well could be interpreted at the time as an indication that the fetus wasn't thriving. Mm. And there are also references to her letters to health, again, more generally during her pregnancy. We think commonly about things like morning sickness, about, you know, swollen ankles and all that. And that's, you know, an experience which have been shared in common across history. And she writes on one occasion, I write as often as I have opportunity. I've been extremely ill of a violent cold. I expect every hour to fall into labour. This seeing the last day of my reckoning, I've not stirred out of my chamber for 3 weeks. And actually, Frances Hatton's story of mothering is actually a very sad one. She had five children, all of whom didn't make it into adulthood. And she also experienced miscarriage as well. And actually, it's quite upsetting in some ways, the way that her miscarriage was spoken about. And that maybe it was because she travelled at the time, and placing that fault. And that's, you know, a difference of understanding to the day about how, you know, these things happen as such. Mm. And you actually hear that in a letter from 1831 from her aunt saying how, after a miscarriage, how dangerously ill Frances Hatton was and how terrifying that was an experience and how fragile life was. And, you know, women were incredibly aware of this and how fragile their motherhood was, how fragile their pregnancies were. And it's actually comes up quite a bit in some of the correspondence that I've read. And it's incredibly heartbreaking, actually, reading some of it.
Yeah, because it almost feels like a terrible burden, you know, because it's a life and death. You're potentially giving life, but you might also give your own life in the process.
And actually, that brings me on to something which, again, you know, there could be incredible joy in pregnancy. And I think this is, you know, common today as well. It can be an incredibly wonderful time, an incredibly powerful time, incredibly special time, but as you say, full of those fears. And I think it's fears, particularly in the early modern period, about giving birth, but also, you know, we've talked about the societal pressures of the expectations that were placed on mothers, not only in their roles as being natural mothers and mothering, but also, as Ruth has talked about, the societal expectations of the sex of your child when they're born. And again, there's quite a devastating letter from Frances Hatton. I think it must have been after the birth of her second daughter. And she writes, "My dear Lord, your last letter has given me the greatest satisfaction in the world." She goes on that he's not, you know, too upset that you had not a boy. "I'm sure I did not. If the loss of my life would have procured you one, I should have been very glad to have laid it down. I hope you'll have another wife that will be able to bring you one, for I had rather be dead than alive. I'm extremely discontented more than ever." So this pressure she felt so heavily on her to have a son rather than a daughter. And, you know, it's not always universal. You see, particularly I've seen it in later accounts, you know, we're happy for a child. You know, it shows that we can have children. It gives future hope for a son. But certainly there was that immense pressure there.
Just ask Catherine of Aragon, Henry VIII's first wife.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we have to be honest about the experience of mothering in the past to present both the good and the bad, the challenges, the grief and the happiness, to really present a view of, you know, without judgment, without putting our present day assumptions on women, about what it really was like, and therefore better understanding what women's lives were like in the past. You know, particularly in elite families without, you know, so much of the pressures of money, large numbers of children, Ruth's already talked about it. And so for women, those cycles of pregnancy, childbirth and early mothering were continual through a lot of their sort of years of when they could have children. And so, you know, a lot of what we've just talked about is actually incredibly difficult to hear and incredibly hard. But in some ways, it's important to be honest about this. And I suppose The last thing I wanted to pick up about on expectant mothers that Ruth has talked about is about, where do you give birth and who do you need around you when you give birth? And again, for Frances Hatton, her aunt writes, really trying to dissuade her in one of her later pregnancies in 1684, in fact, her last pregnancy, to not go to Guernsey to give birth. Her husband was there a lot of the time and Frances was alone, solo parenting a lot of the time because he was governor over in Guernsey. And she said, it's not a fit place for you to lie in. It's not a fit place. It doesn't have any midwife, doesn't have any conveniences in case something does go wrong. And so, you know, as Ruth said, they're constantly preparing for the future of motherhood, preparing for what might happen during childhood, preparing themselves for all these different things. And there's a real sort of physical and also sociological effect and impact on women having birth in the early modern period.
Yes, and I'm surprised that they weren't put off by the rocking of a boat, you know, down to the Channel Islands, because obviously Guernsey is part of the Channel Islands in the English Channel. So I'm surprised that that was even discussed.
Yeah, and it was very much discussed from the point of view of Frances wanting to go and not being alone. And I think she really did struggle. And I suspect, you know, if we put present day assumptions on it, whether she experienced depression or post-age depression, any of those things, I don't know. But she wanted to be with her husband. And it comes out later, actually, how important, when she had her children, their company was to her and how fulfilling that was.
Yeah, interesting. So, yes, for her anyway, that was a couple experience then. It wasn't just something that happened between women and ladies in waiting sort of thing.
Ultimately, it was, because actually her husband was away during and after many of the births of her children, and perhaps wouldn't even see them for quite a while, perhaps even more so when they're a girl rather than a boy, in terms of prioritising. So no, it's sort of, as Ruth said, that childbirth in the period is a place of women supporting women and friendship and care.
So really the men were very hands off and busy working.
Largely, yes, and particularly before 1750, the men were often further away, but you do see some men getting closely involved. And there's one example of a woman giving birth quite quickly, and her husband actually has to play the role of nurse, and the nurse that they'd hired in had to play the role of the accouchere because they were so desperate for somebody in order to help her with that childcare. And in that particular family, the man was very hands-on and hates going away into town, and he's constantly wanting to come back. So we do see a real diversity, as we do today, of some parents being, you know, very much a couple and bringing up the children, and others it falling very much on the responsibility of one rather than the other. And when mothers died in childbirth, fathers sometimes had to take on that role of mothering. Mothering isn't necessarily just a woman's role. Fathers could sometimes do it as well.
Okay, so once a child is born, Megan, what was it like for new mothers? And I gather you've got a couple of properties where you've got some stories to tell.
Let's continue for just a little bit with the Hattons again, because their correspondence is just so incredibly rich. And actually, across some of what I've read, and Ruth, you've probably found this as well, you hear a lot of the sort of affection and pride which mothers took in their children. And I found particularly a lot more written about when they're younger children, though we'll talk about them as adult children later. Joy in what we would call milestones today, joy in having their company, in sharing things that the mothers enjoy with their children. There is also the concern over childhood illness, and also the illness of mothers as well comes up in the correspondence of the Hattons. And, you know, there's so much in there, so I won't read their full correspondence out to you, but just sort of to pick a few. So for Cicely Hatton, she talks quite a lot about her first two children, Anne Hatton. I think written a nanny quite a lot in the letters. I always wonder whether it's an A or Annie and an N, but I think it is nanny. And Margaret, also known as Meg. So you get these sort of familial terms coming through in the correspondence. And she writes how her daughters thrive, of their beauty. She writes of things like problems with wind, which I think mothers today would be very familiar with. Then being tired and cranky. Her mother-in-law also talks very fondly of the children and, you know, things that, again, we understand today, you know, a child crying themselves to sleep in the cradle, being upset about being put down for the night. And I think there's just this wonderful letter which she writes where you really sort of get the pride she has in her children, where she goes, Nan or Anne talks perpetually and runs like a lapwing, which is a kind of bird. I dare not trust her without the strings. Meg knows me and hath done so good while, and has done for a good while, and hath a world of understanding. And I think that's sort of, when I read this, I was fascinated actually that's about strings. Baby reins and the debates around baby reins is not a new thing. And that they've been around since the 16th century for exactly the same reason, stopping tumbles and babies running off. And so actually, when you look at portraiture, if you ever look at some portraiture of young children, in the period, keep an eye out for the leading strings sewn into their clothes or pinned onto their clothing. I was fascinated by that. And a lot of similar things come through in France's letters. I've sort of already mentioned the comfort that she gains from her children while her husband is often away. And I think there's this wonderful one where she's moaning that Susanna has always had a cold, but she's playing in your closet. So that's her father's closet, now by me. And I asked her whose it was. She says, dear papa's, as plain as I can speak, and Ernest, my lord's heart would be broke if I had not her and her sister with me, for they are all the diversions I have now in the world. And actually, it's important to point out that Frances Hatton also cared for the daughter of Christopher Hatton's first wife, Anne, after she had died. And Ruth, you might know a bit more about this than me, the sort of picture of stepmothers in the period. And clearly that Frances really adored her stepdaughter. But I think quite often stepmothers and mothering as a stepmother was portrayed in quite a negative light at the time.
So yes, it absolutely was in terms of the popular literature. But actually in reality, we see so very many cases where you do get that strong degree of affection. And we get some, you know, quite remarkable examples where people are acting as mothers for their husband's illegitimate children that they'd had before the couple had got married, but continuing to take on that mothering role. So it is notable actually how the biological tie wasn't always there and needed to be there for that care to be demonstrated.
And there's another mother, a new mum, who has left some records for historians to ponder on. This is at Rest Park in Bedfordshire.
Yes, Jemima Marchioness Grey inherited Rest Park in 1740, soon after her marriage to Philip York. And they had two children, Amabel and Mary. And just looking through the correspondence with just one of the people she wrote to, her actually very young aunt, Mary Gregory, who was only slightly older than she was, you get again some of those details that you see in the Hatton correspondence of looking after a young child, from things like teething, the fondness of them, then beginning to recognise and know them as parents, and also sort of starting to learn about the child, their likes and dislikes and things like that. And I think there's just two things I wanted to pull out of this. There's just a beautiful letter in June 1751, which describes the incredible joy that Jemima felt of seeing her newborn daughter arriving at Rest Park. And Jemima was always very expressive about her emotional attachment and affection to Rest Park, and that sharing that with her daughter was really sort of special and important to her. First of all, she comments that she was a great traveller. You know, she's so young that actually her wants are fewer and more easily satisfied than they probably ever would be again. And she writes, "She will easily believe it is with much pleasure I see her here. I have reason to reflect with the utmost gratitude on the many accumulated blessings I have enjoyed at this place, and of the thousand new emotions to my heart she felt when seeing her daughter arriving there in the carriage." And I think there's something so wonderful about that, and that actually they would go on to both enjoy and love Rest Park going forward, and they both did a lot in the gardens together. And that's really a wonderful sort of moment in motherhood, that sort of arriving home moment almost. And then the joy that Amabel brought to the house. She writes that she enlivens the house. She is seldom still or silent. She also writes about the challenges of parting with her. And I think that's something that many mothers will experience today. The fears, you know, that if she's going away travelling, she's breaking up the family, but she likes seeing new things, and leaving her child behind was so difficult. And then I also wanted to just pull out one other thing. And I find this sort of quite fascinating personally, where she writes a letter in which she talks a lot about her daughter to her aunt. And she talks about not passing it on, not getting it to the hands of anyone else. Because she writes, "It is no production of wit and genius, no flights of fancy here. All is shockingly stupid, homespun, and unlike everything that is ingenious. What could she possibly think of it if it got into the hands of someone else? Oh, once more, have a watchful eye to my reputation." And I think that just sort of highlights the change in some ways that she experienced as a motherhood in this new experience in her life. Jemima was incredibly intellectual. She loved reading, and she wrote these really witty, clever, as she put, flights of fancy letters to her network of friends and acquaintances. And actually, for some, mothering and showing that side of her to that group was something that perhaps she didn't want to do. That's sort of how I interpret it anyway. And that, you know, it's a part of her, but not the whole of her. And I think that's so interesting when you think about contemporary identity, about mothering and how it fits into work and how it fits into your domestic life or not, and things like that. So I think, you know, there are so many things that are present in the past that are still, you know, relevant today.
There's a lot to draw on there. And I liked your use in the text there of the watchful eye, because that sort of leads us on to our next question about education and bringing up the children and teaching them. To what extent were mothers teachers to their children, Ruth, first of all?
Well, yeah, it was a very important role for mothers to take on. Most children were educated at home while they were very young, and mothers shaped both their academic and, of course, their social education, which is a really important part of what they were doing. And it was important to families that they were successfully rearing children who could continue the family duties, whether that was to be an aristocrat, if it was an elite household, or as a farmer or an artisan or a trader or whatever family business the children were going to go into. Our mothers often played, you know, a really important role in this. And if you look at the books that elite women were buying, they often included educational texts such as Aesop's Fables, as well as other texts, including work by Rousseau, which was guiding them about how to educate their children. And then as they got a bit older, the sons often went to school if they could afford to pay school fees, but daughters tended to stay at home. And the eldest daughter of Georgiana, 5th Duchess of Devonshire, has quite a complex and educational experience. She writes her notes about her education as a teenager. And it's including all sorts of things, including history books that she was reading. She was working her way through Shakespearean plays. She's reading the Gentleman's Magazine, which we know has mathematical puzzles in. And we think some of this was undertaken by her governess, some of this training. But there's also bits of it which were about social life. And one of them includes understanding the nature of intimacies, which may be a suggestion to sex education, or it may actually be about gossip within London and who you should make friends with. And it very much suggests that her mother, the 5th Duchess of Devonshire, who was right at the heart of fashionable society, was preparing her daughter in order to take that role herself when she became an adult.
Megan, what's your impression of the teaching that mothers would have given to their young children?
Very much sort of, as Ruth has said, playing this important role in their lives. And I think, you know, Ruth sort of highlighted that we've gone through that it's also important to remember that teaching could come from aunts as well, or grandmothers. And I think the example which comes to mind is Henrietta Howard at Marble Hill in London. She was estranged from her own son, but she cared for her niece and nephew and later her great niece as they grew up. And you see it particularly with her great niece, the sort of household that she occupied with all the greats and goods and of society and literary minds, and how it had that social education and that cultural and intellectual education, as well as, you know, what was right for a lady to do or not. So you see it both in sort of the birthing parents, biological mothers, as well as in this wider network of actually particularly women who helped support the education of children.
Well, let's talk about some of those other women. Staff, were they involved in privileged households in raising the family's children?
Most certainly they were. And you know, this does include women who were there primarily to educate the children. And if you think about households in the 16th and 17th centuries, quite a lot of the servants were kinspeople. So you may well have aunts and uncles, sort of younger aunts and uncles, hired by another household. And that was part of the way in which they were trained into becoming aristocrats. And so we know, for example, that Grace Mildmay, who was an adult woman, lived in Apethorpe in Northamptonshire, that she was educated by somebody called Mistress Hamblin in the 1560s. And this Mistress Hamblin seems to have been a kinswoman, probably her aunt, who had previously been taught her own skills by Grace Mildmay's mother. And amongst the things that Mistress Hamblin taught, you know, the young Grace Mildmay was how to take accounts, how to write, her skills in music, embroidery and art. But she was also probably central to encouraging Grace in her medical expertise, the thing for which Grace is best known today.
And you see these sort of roles going through into the 19th century. So the example which comes to mind is Lady Jane Braybrooke at Audley End, who came to live in the house in the 1820s. And I don't know, Ruth, whether the similar anxiety existed that you sort of see in the literature of the time, the worries about people like governesses becoming substitute mothers. I think for Jane, we know that she chose to use a wet nurse rather than nursing herself. So that's another way that you see mothering coming in, which is not necessarily the biological mother per se. And we see payments for a wet nurse, Mrs. White, in 1827 after the birth of her son going on, and then before another wet nurse is employed. And, you know, I think nursing is a point where probably there's been a great deal of conversation, both in the past and present. And you see it in the 17th century, the Lady Hatton so concerned about feeding and worrying about the success in it. But you also see these anxieties, which you've brought out also about the use of wet nurses or not, and how that changes culturally at the time. And we know at Audley End, some of the governess was there. And I think very interestingly, in the 1830s, you get a longer term governess, Mary Dormer, who arrived and seems to have been there for most of the childhood of the Braybrookes. And these individuals, these women, often occupied really important places in their life. And it's interesting that after she retired, she was still at Audley End. And it suggests sort of the importance to her. But I think it's also worth remembering that this didn't necessarily mean, if you had a governess, that the mothers themselves were disinterested in what was going on. And Lady Braybrooke seems to have probably been quite heavily involved in the education of her children, particularly the girls, and wasn't sort of a totally distant figure who handed off her children to someone else and disappeared. And at times when she was separated from her children, she wrote really regularly to them. And also she wrote regularly to her governess about how they were doing, how they were getting on. She was involved in the managing of the nursery accounts and things like that. So I think there's this interesting sort of spectrum and of mothering and motherhood within sort of a community of people who cared for these children, and that these individuals could be really, really important to the family.
Yes, well, they were making sure that they survived and inherited and carried on the dynasty, I suppose. It's quite an important job.
It is, but that's also where you sometimes get these anxieties about the other servants as well playing a role. Many children spent time with the servants in the household, the people who were the cooks or the housekeeper and others within it. And there was a real worry that they might pass on bad habits. If the parents went away, they were often left in the care of senior servants. But it's actually quite interesting to think about the ways in which them spending time with those other household members could prepare them for their adult roles. Not only were these people making sure that the children didn't befall an accident, but we see examples of them going out shooting, even though they're quite young, learning how to manage the estates and also how to run a household themselves when they had servants of their own.
And just to recap on some of the job titles that you've used, which many people might not recognise today, a wet nurse, is this a woman who would actually breastfeed in lieu of the mother?
Yes, absolutely. And breastfeeding, aristocratic mothers breastfeeding their children was not that common until round about 1700s, 1720s. We do get, you know, examples of it happening. But because there was this perception, which has a little bit of scientific underpinning, but only marginally, that breastfeeding works as a contraceptive, there was a real worry about women breastfeeding their own children for extended periods of time. So they often got wet nurses in. Later on in the 18th century, breastfeeding children yourself became more and more fashionable. And when Georgiana, 5th Duchess of Devonshire, one of the great leaders of the Bon Ton in the latter part of the 18th century, started to be seen to be breastfeeding her children, it was known amongst society. That really did help it being seen as being part of what the fashionable mama was doing.
I'm not much of a biologist, so if you haven't given birth to the child, how do you produce breast milk?
They were normally women who'd given birth to other children, and so they were mothers themselves, and they continued breastfeeding and continued producing milk. And sometimes in poorer communities, you see that they used wet nurses, so that if a mother couldn't breastfeed her own children, the child would be sent to a wet nurse, and those wet nurses sometimes fed quite a large number of children. So they were women who had fallen pregnant, but just not with that particular child.
And I think it's sort of important to note that in terms of feeding, there's the choice element of it and the fashion side of it and whether or not to. But there are also the challenges that some women experienced in feeding. It doesn't always work and things. And we see this going back to 17th century, Frances Hatton, who's really concerned. She was desperate to feed, interestingly, and have that connection with her child. But she's very concerned that her child isn't sucking right and is preferring a spoon over feeding. And actually, I had to look this up when I read it, and that one of her members of her family sent for a puppy dog to draw her breast. And sort of, if the child wasn't sucking appropriately and getting milk flowing, that you could feed an animal, I believe, to try and keep your milk up. So there's a whole set of complicated things going on around feeding across the period we're talking about.
Could a wet nurse become a governess at a later stage in her career?
I don't know. I've never heard of it, Ruth, but I don't know whether you have.
No, I've never heard of it. And I think that, you know, wet nurses were rarely of the same socioeconomic background as governesses. It's not the nicest job to do, really. And governesses tended to be more, they were educated, so they tended to be more middling sort. So they tend to be quite different. Some of them may have been baby nurses. So that's to say, looking after the child when they were quite young. And they're quite different from governesses. So you get people who look after smaller children, and wet nurses may have taken on that particular role, but they are normally distinct governesses and wet nurses.
And a governess is basically like the in-house teacher for the children, is that right?
Yes, and tutor of some sort. And they also got other tutors in who would come and teach for, you know, specific elements. So they would come and teach them how to do dancing or music during the 18th century. I like teasing my big brother about this. Guitars were very much a girl's instrument. So there were guitars and guitar teachers travelling around the country. And so we see these specialist tutors coming in and training the young women in a whole host of different skills for a short period of time. And likewise, the sons in terms of dancing or maybe even sword play and horse riding.
Now, moving into later life, how did women of the period in the 1500s to the 1800s, Ruth, manage the relationships with their grown-up children?
Well, of course, this is really important. We tend to think about mothers and children and think of little ones, but if we think about what Mothering Sunday is about, or particularly, you know, from the 18th century onwards, it was very much a celebration of adult or young adult children going back in mid-Lent to visit their mothers, taking with them sweet treats such as simnel cakes, and that celebration of an adult child-mother relationship. And that reflects the ways in which the role of mother doesn't stop once the child left home. And so elite mothers were involved in a whole set of different bits of their children's transition into adulthood and beyond. They may well have helped shape the courting, setting up parties in order so that they could meet potential suitors. But also once the children had become parents and running their own households, they may well have played quite a central role in shaping their life, giving them advice, finding them jobs. And if the mother was widowed, as a great many were, they would have had to have played a leading role in shaping their children's education and journey into roles, whether it was running a country house into the armed service or following a career in trade or somewhere else. And letters from mothers often show an ongoing concern about their offspring's health and then in turn their grandchildren's health and well-being. And many of them, many mothers interfered with the lives of their grandchildren a great deal, whether it was organising governesses or sending them gifts, which meant that the parents were sort of shaped into making certain decisions. And mothers were also keen to have guidance for their children for once they had gone. So Grace Mildmay, who I mentioned before, she wrote quite a lot of texts, but this included a book of medical recipes. And this was in part to give to her daughter and granddaughter in order to pass down through the female line the medical knowledge that she had gathered. For those who were concerned about their family's dynastic legacy, which was a great many mothers, inheritance of knowledge and traditions was really important to them.
And I think to sort of draw on that, to go back to Anne Clifford and that transition down the female line of inheritance and of property. I mean, the story of Lady Anne Clifford is comparatively well known as one of the only surviving children of the third Earl of Cumberland. By an entail dating back to the 14th century, she expected to inherit her father's estate when he died, but these actually went to her uncle. And so ensued a 40-year legal battle to regain Anne's inheritance, which included Brough and Browne Castle, which are now in the care of English Heritage. And actually just up the road from Browne Castle is the Countess Pillar. And this is an incredible, what it says on the tin, pillar with crests on the top and sundials, which marks a spot where Anne last saw her mother being Margaret Clifford, where she and I had a grievous and heavy parting, she wrote, before her mother died in 1616. And I think it's testament to the relationship between them, but also testament to the importance of Margaret in supporting Lady Anne Clifford as an adult. I say adult, depends when you argue adulthood begins, but in sort of her teens into her 20s. And you see the importance of each other in their lives, and in particular, the beginning and aiding of Anne in that legal battle to her inheritance. And her mother really sort of is a dominant figure in her life. She begins the lawsuits and she faces opposition from the king and loads of men in power. And she continued to be a source of knowledge and advice and sort of a strategy to Anne in terms of regaining this inheritance. And indeed, the last parting from her mother was after a trip to seek her counsel in matters on inheritance with Lady Anne Clifford's husband. And so that marking of that moment and almost sort of represents that counsel and the importance of her in her life. And it really has been noted by historians that Anne's matrilineal heritage, the heritage through the female line, and her mother really was of the greatest importance to her. who showed her upbringing and strength by the bringing up of my said dear daughter, I did, as it were, even suck the milk of her goodness, which made my mind strong against the storms of fortune. So yeah, that passing on of knowledge and making sure that inheritance went to Anne Clifford sort of ties into what some of Ruth has just been saying.
In episode 253, though, we did talk about the dynamic between Queen Victoria and her eldest son, Bertie. Is there some debate, Megan, about Queen Victoria's relationship or relationships with her children?
Yeah, it's quite interesting how Queen Victoria has been understood and perceived as a mother in history and in historiography, so the writing of history. She had 9 children born over the course of 17 years, so cycles of pregnancy and childbirth would have made up a really significant part of her life. And I think some of our listeners might be familiar with the assertion, which some historians have forwarded, that she didn't especially like pregnancy. I mean, I don't blame her in some instances. She particularly liked children or being a mother. She described pregnancy as being like a dog or a cow. And in 1859, by the time she'd had her 9 children, says of babies, an ugly baby is a very nasty object, and the prettiest is frightful when undressed until about 4 months, is short as long as they have their big body and little limbs and that terrible frog-like action. But some, such as Yvonne Ward, the historian, have questioned the perceived indifference and dislike of motherhood of Queen Victoria, certainly in the early years of her mothering, and the impact of what historical sources have been published and used to paint that negative picture. You know, we're changeable beings, our opinions change over time, our experiences that form these change over time. And so depending on which sources you draw upon can paint a very different picture of how motherhood was experienced by the Queen. Indeed, while there are some comments of her dislike of pregnancy, nursing and children, there's also evidence that she enjoyed her experiences of early motherhood in those early experiences of becoming mother, certainly. And after the birth of her first child, she wrote, "Now that I have returned to my usual habits and no longer have a nurse about me, it seems to me like a dream having a child." And she talks about frequently seeing her children and her first child, Vicky, often, and that they were brought down while they were dressing for dinner and how she was showing them off to everyone. And I think it's just worth briefly thinking about motherhood and monarchy and how those interacted for Queen Victoria, and what it might have meant to her when she became a mother, the difficult relationship between those competing roles of womanliness and all subordination in a relationship, in a marriage, and also queenship and being the mother to a whole nation. And pregnancy and childbirth would at times have made performing her duties difficult, physical symptoms of pregnancy, as well as sort of psychological, physiological. It's now accepted that Queen Victoria probably experienced at times what we would consider postnatal depression, describing lowness and a tendency to cry. And she wrote after the birth of her first daughter, "Men never think, at least seldom think, what a hard task it is for us women to go through this very often." And I think as she went through pregnancy after pregnancy, it must have taken quite a toll on her. And the loss of control over her body is something which comes up. The loss of control over her position as a monarch and Albert sort of stepping in. He was to be the regent if anything happened to Victoria in childbirth. And that difficult tension that it created between her desire to perform her role and her desire to be a mother must have been really challenging in those early years of motherhood. Perhaps something, though, you know, we don't have the challenges necessarily of being a monarch and being a mother, but you might have the tensions of performing your work or your job and being a mother, and how that could make it quite difficult. Though it's safe to say that's is drawn from a lot of the work which Ward has done on her early mothering. But every child is different. Every relationship with every child is different. And certainly her relationships with her different children going through into adulthood were varied. You know, she may have been disappointed with Bertie at occasion, but she adored Beatrice, her last child. So it really is complicated as to how we view that and her relationships with her children.
Yes, complicated is a good word, because this is a huge subject. How did motherhood, broadly speaking, evolve over the 4 centuries that we've been talking about with the families we've described? Ruth, first of all.
Well, traditionally, if you were reading a history book that was written in the 1970s, for example, you would have read that parents cared very little for their children in the earlier time periods. because infant mortality was so high, they didn't develop that close love for them. And evidence of motherly affection was really only seen in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. But as we've heard from the examples that Megan has given us and lots of other examples, we can see that there was actually a great deal of affection between mothers and their children throughout the time period we've been talking about today. We do see slight changes in language, probably more playfulness appearing within the letters and particularly in public discussions of parenthood, greater use of pet names, and again, Megan's told us about some of those, and more parents willing to talk publicly about their hands-on care that they undertook for their children in the later 18th century, some of which we start seeing celebrated in art. And there were some changes in childbirth. It became increasingly medicalised. It was less of a female-only space. And there's also, much to the relief of some mothers, particularly Queen Victoria, greater use of pain relief. Victoria, for example, used chloroform anaesthesia during the delivery of her seventh child, Leopold, in 1853. But generally, I would possibly suggest that there's more continuity than change when we look at mother-child relationships. As with now, being a parent could be really difficult, and not every woman really relished the role. But for very many, it was shaped by a great deal of care and affection and joy.
I don't like to ask this question almost directly because it almost indicates that I haven't got respect for mothers, which is completely the opposite. But I have to ask, why is it important to talk about the experiences that mothers had in the past?
Well, I think it's really important to talk about the experience of mothers in the past. And actually, perhaps if you looked at literature decades ago, actually, you might have asked that question, why are we not talking more about motherhood and the experiences of mothers in the past? I think it's not only important to talk about them, but think about how we talk about mothering and motherhood. Tomorrow, Friday, the 8th of March, is International Women's Day, and it has me thinking about lots of things about the interaction of feminism and sort of being defined by childbearing and fighting against that with maternity and women's history and that complicated relationship that goes into talking and thinking about mothering. And I think we have to recognise, first of all, that a lot of what we've talked about today is quite a narrow Anglo-centric and elite version of mothering. Mothering is different for everyone. And I think being honest and talking about, as Ruth said, all those different kinds of experiences, the good and bad, is really important. And the work of women's historians and academics in motherhood studies to deconstruct motherhood as something socially and culturally constructed is so important, and not only helps us understand the past, but also the ancestry of assumptions today and the continuities that Ruth talked about today. And I think what social women's history, which considering mothering, also does, it shows that the acts of mothering were important. You know, we've talked about the role of women in furthering families, in making sure inheritance passed to certain children, in doing all these caring roles, in educating the future in the elite society leaders of the country. And that actually talking about mothering and motherhood is important, it matters. And whilst there are bits of injustice and oppression, it could also be empowering for women. And, you know, this is all really important that we do this and also centre the voices of women and birthing parents and recognise their experience. This is not just sort of the history of childhood or parenting. It all ties in together, but they're, you know, it can centre around those stories of women. And this can undoubtedly be hard to do sometimes with the evidence that survives. But in thinking about those wider contexts and in listening to those words of women, we can do it. And we can do it in a way that's not necessarily sugar-coated and idealised, like those concepts of motherhood in the past and what women should be and shouldn't be, but talking about the joys of mothering, being honest about its messiness and its challenging. And, you know, it's through changes over the decades, which meant that we can do that. We can talk about that. So it's so incredibly important. And both in understanding the experiences of women in the past in relation to our sites, and also understanding mothering and motherhood today.
And of motherhood today, obviously, there are continuing changes, even in the 21st century, with laws around maternity and paternity as well. Motherhood continues to change. I suppose we could all agree on that, can't we?
Oh, absolutely. And what's really interesting, what I find most interesting about the study of motherhood is that when you look at the ideals of motherhood, as Megan was saying, they don't just tell you about parenting. They actually tell you about society. If you find out what an ideal mother was doing or the idealisation of motherhood, you actually find out what people thought the ideal society should be like as well. And motherhood's crucial to all of us. None of us would be here without our mums. And so that means it's going to continue to be a topic that's under investigation. Mothers are going to continue to have those levels of interference. And that just tells us just how important motherhood is to every single society.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, motherhood is changing and the means of those conversation is definitely changing. I look on my social media feed and I encounter mumfluencers. It is a thing. You hear about different versions of motherhood now. And there's such a spectrum now because so many people have a voice through digital means. You hear about crunchy mums or silky mums. And I had to sit there and look on my social media and Google what some of those mean. And these different identities that women create for themselves, which is sort of a double-edged sword, actually, in some ways, because we are recreating different versions of idealized motherhood in social media today. But also women have more of a voice to create those versions of motherhood. And it's constantly changing. Medicine's changing. We talked about how it changed for Queen Victoria. Ideas about women's rights within working environments, about, as you've talked about, rights to maternity and paternity leave, rights around reproductive health and things like that. So constantly changing, constantly evolving. And as Ruth has so beautifully said, always so important. And that's why these conversations are always happening.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Just before we go, we've got a brand new Ask the Experts episode coming up soon. So if you've got anything you'd like to know about medieval knights and jousting, ask away. Simply email your questions to podcast@english-heritage.org.uk. Next week, we'll go behind the scenes of a new art installation at Belsay Hall, Castle and Gardens in Northumberland.
So there's lots of uses of different materials and how do you balance that together? And hopefully that work, the wood, the tiles, just thinking about producing artworks that then can be returned to the site that they came from.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.